Michael Hulse, and I teach here. This is Elizabeth Smither, who's come all the way from New Zealand for a tour. She was at Aldborough. Last night she was reading in Oxford. Tomorrow, if I remember rightly, is Manchester. She's included us in her tour to launch this book, which you can buy afterwards outside. It's a selection of her poetry. And it's my pleasure this evening to introduce Elizabeth to you, and she'll be then reading for about 25 minutes, half an hour. We'll talk a little after that. There'll be opportunities for you to ask questions, and she will close off the evening with a couple of more questions, poems. We do the questions, she does the poems, at the end of the evening. Let me tell you a little about Elizabeth Smither. It must be about 20 years ago that I first read poems by her. I think it was her book, Professor Musgrove's Canary, which introduced me to her writing. By now, she's produced, what, about 12 or 13 collections of poems at a rough count, I would say.
About 12.
There we go. As a poet, she has received every significant award that New Zealand has to offer. She's been invited to many places around the world as well to read her poetry. In New Zealand, most recently, she has been Poet Laureate. In New Zealand, they have a revolving system as they do in the States. You have the office for 2 years, and Elizabeth was the third in that office. She also received the Montana Book Award for her last book of poems before the laureateship book. She is a writer whose poetry, I think you'll feel very strongly this evening, has an extraordinary vibrancy and distinctiveness, an alertness to everyday detail, at the same time as it never takes its eye off the larger picture. And it's that marrying of the local detail and the facts of the way people lead their lives to much larger issues to do with theological and philosophical questions of the profoundest kind, but always very lightly expressed. It's this that I particularly find extremely attractive always in her poetry. But it would be terrible if I didn't also mention, although she's here wearing her poetry hat this evening, that she is a very distinguished writer of fiction. She has now published three novels, and 4 books of short stories. The most recent book of short stories was Listening to the Everly Brothers and Other Stories, and I have to say, at the risk of saying the wrong thing on an evening devoted to poetry, that I adore her short stories. And my one grief this evening is that they're not on sale outside there, that the fiction isn't there with the poems as well. But you can always go and catch up on that in your copious free time. She is a first-rate writer, and I believe you're in for a treat this evening. So without more ado, let me hand you over to Elizabeth. I've asked her if she will just say a few words before actually launching into the first poem, so that you can get a little accustomed, in case you're not used to it, to the New Zealand accent, which just occasionally can be a little unfamiliar to people, can it not? But having said that, let me now hand you over to Elizabeth, and I'd like to welcome her in the usual way.
Thank you very much, Michael, and I do apologize, my accent is a New Zealand accent, and when I was at Aldborough, someone said later to me, speak a little more slowly because they have to get used to your accent. And I was just going to tell Michael a funny story about the stories. The story, Listening to the Everly Brothers, which is the title story, I used lots of lines from the Everly Brothers songs in it. And of course, then I ran into all sorts of difficulties because of copyright. So I think I ended up paying something like $1,800 to the rights for the songs. I only used single lines, you know, from the Everly Brothers songs, because two of the characters spoke in dialogue using lines from the songs. But because American copyright law is so severe, particularly with regard to music, I had to face this enormous bill to get the rights for these, just to use these lines. So it's the most expensive story, Michael, I've ever written. I think I'll just read. Shall I just read for a little while? And then we can have some questions and... Shall I put my little... OK. Oh, yes. Okay. I'm going to read over here. So, but if you can't hear, just raise your hands and do something, and I'll try to... Is that all right? Can you hear that all right? Good, okay. What I normally do is, when I'm doing a reading, I normally type the poems out in very large typeface, and then I get so nervous I have to put my glasses on as well. So they're sort of an 18-point type or 20-point type, but I get so nervous I put the glasses on as well. Which is all quite silly, really. The first two poems I'd like to read are about friendship. This is a friend called Bess, and we've been friends since high school. And we go on shopping expeditions together. In fact, one of the last things I did in New Zealand before I came to Britain was to go on another shopping expedition with her. But what has happened over the years is that if I propel Beth into buying something, she always has her revenge on me and I have to buy something as well. So it's always equally balanced. And sure enough, on the last shopping trip, she bought something, I bought something. So it's not a good shopping trip unless we both abide by the rules. So this is just called Shopping with Beth. You buy something, black shoes, not what you intended. You have closets of black shoes, and once I saw them laid out along the hallway, polished by your husband, at least six shiny black pairs. Still, now it's time for me to buy something. Friendship is about equality. Hiding from you in the changing cubicle, you throw skirts, jerseys, blouses over the partition, and standing for the umpteenth time in front of my reflection in the mirror, I try them on, then comb my hair, check my lipstick, and come out saying like a poetry editor, not quite what I was looking for, but nice. And then finally I buy a black jersey with a V-neckline. I have heaps of black jerseys, you have black shoes. We've just repeated ourselves. Our friendship is basic black, like the little black dress. We regress. But in the last shop, we choose bikinis, as if we would wear them. I choose black, and you go for rainbow colours. And the next poem is about another friend called Carol, who is a secret smoker. She was supposed to have given up at the same time as her husband, who is a surgeon. But she hasn't, not completely. So I sometimes smoke with her behind buildings and all sorts of odd places. I'm not a smoker at all, but I always smoke with Carol because it's a sort of a gesture of friendship in a way. So she always rolls two cigarettes when she comes, and I always have one with her. What I love about it is the sort of complicity of it. Smoking with Carol, filter tips, then menthol, lastly, roll your own with geriatric threads of tobacco hanging and lick spittle sealed. Come, you used to indicate, rolling two in the laundry and carrying them with the plastic lighter in your fist, out past the swimming pool, around the Virginia creeper to the seat where smoke could float over an entire valley and quickly dissipate. You lit yours first. I positioned mine into your cupped palms, or kissed edge to smouldering, slow flaring edge. Breathe deep, as if we breathe together, for surely conspirators' breaths are synchronized. Often mine went out, or I left the end, not asking for another kiss of life. Company or conspiracy were better than any vice or discovery later that the giveaway lighter had been left behind. And for breath, there were peppermints, or a pre-dinner drink, white wine and smoke dissolving together, cloudy bay, and our complicit smiles, smoke screwed up eyes. And the next two are about France. I didn't go to France until I was quite old, and I had very inadequate French, very inadequate, a lot of arm waving and so forth. Though I did know how to say, I am not from here, je ne suis pas d'ici. But I did find it very charming one night to be accosted by a young French woman and asked directions. I don't think she believed me. In fact, I was lost myself. I set out to find a shop called the Sheep with Five Leads, which is a designer clothing shop which sells designer clothing with the labels ripped out. But I never did find the shop. But the young woman did follow me, and we did find the Rue Dauphine. Causing someone to follow in a foreign language. Je ne suis pas d'ici, I say to the young woman who asks direction, but I do know where the Rue Dauphine is. Follow me under your umbrella. My French is broken and peculiar, and I am older. A heavy shower, though she's uncertain, binds us together. We walk in single file through the same puddles, and several times I stop to listen if she's following, like Eurydice, this vocabulary-less Orpheus, not with a flute, but a leading umbrella. And several times I turn to smile, and she smiles back as it thunders overhead, and people run to shelter in shop doorways. But I know the way, as Orpheus did, past the market where chickens are roasting and chestnuts, and around the corner, and here is the Rue Dauphine, and here the Pont Neuf, and I believe I hear her say, voila, and merci, madame, merci, au revoir, mademoiselle, and I glow under my umbrella like a peony. And you can do lots of lovely free things in a big city. I was in Saint-Sulpice, which was the church nearest where I was staying, reading the notices and looking at the memorial plaques while a private funeral was taking place in the Lady Chapel. And I hung about because the organ, the beautiful big organ, was being played at Saint-Sulpice. Mass times, I read, choir practices at. Then the great organ begins, and I loiter, reading the notices over and over. César Franck strides like a wind. The sanctuary of the martyrs lights up by one of those peculiarities of slanted light. And the funeral in the Lady Chapel is just the excuse. One soul and a cast of 20 raise thousands. Now, this one is set in Sydney. I had arrived in Sydney on a blisteringly hot day and got into a cab with a very, very irritable taxi driver. But as we were driving along the suburb of Glebe, I saw this beautiful vision waiting at the traffic lights. It was a young girl who looked just like a Botticelli angel in a flowing white dress with her hand holding the leash of a wolfhound. I was so excited, I gave the driver a large tip, which he instantly cheered up. Girl and Wolfhound at Glebe. So might it be titled in a painting, deep framed in gold silver light, gold summer light, and underneath a little polished plaque, Girl and her Wolfhound at Glebe. Take out the crass crossing lights and hold them momentarily together, stilled as the artist always wishes, creating the subject onto which to shimmer, the pale, near-transparent, long white dress, loose hanging below the elaborate braided hair, in which, what artifice, small crystals wink and glitter. And the wolfhound, so rumpled, shaggy, half depleted of his fur, except that is his style, as if he's just risen from lying uncombed at his mistress's feet, and is instantly on the lookout for wolves of the suburban variety. His leash hangs in her gentle hand, an arc. He half wanders, being too royal to succumb to any command other than her poise. And the next one is quite an old poem that Michael will know. It's called A Cortege of Daughters, and it's about a funeral that I went to. It was the father of one of my youngest son's, the father of one of my youngest son's friends, and it wasn't a dismal funeral. It wasn't going very well at all. I know that's a silly thing to say, but some funerals are beautiful, others are not, and this one was in the not category. Until, at the end of the funeral, the daughters and daughters-in-law of the man got up and carried the casket out of the church. And this was quite a long time ago, and it was quite unusual for a woman to play that role in a funeral, and it looked extremely beautiful. A Cortege of Daughters. A quite ordinary funeral, the corpse unknown to the priest, the 23rd Psalm, the readings by serious businessmen, one who nearly tripped on the unaccustomed pew, the kneelers and the sitters like sheep and goats. But by some prior determination, a row of daughters and daughters-in-law rose to act as pallbearers instead of men, all of even height and beautiful. One wore in her hair a black and white striped bow, and in the midst of their queenliness, one in dark flowered silk. The corpse had become a man before they left the porch, so loved he had his own dark barge, which their slow-moving steps rowed, as a dark lake is sometimes surrounded by irises. Now the next two poems are about cases of formal control. The first is the large doll's house made by a friend, which made me wish that I was doll-sized myself, because it was so beautiful. Doll's house. Chaos indoors and out, those surfaces are cleaned, the sink bench, the garden leaves raked, and only one or two besmear the endless efforts of staying here. I enjoy breathing, an aged rock star says, and hushed reverent applause. Why didn't we think of that? Make a song out of it and a dance. But on your dresser, a cleared space allows a large doll's house to poise, now you've assembled it, with screws and instructions. The hinged front, complete with comprehensive door, opens out onto the stage you've chosen to create, detail by detail this winter. Your double bed, single occupied, lies behind, slightly rumpled with cushions at the head, a stuffed toy or two, but the doll's house's rooms are empty and pristine as only emptiness can do. Hell is other dolls, J.P. Sartre said, and if you want to keep a situation clear, banish every living soul, let furniture speak for itself and occupancy as well. For someone, doll size is surely coming here tonight or after a fabled holiday to proceed up the stairs to bed or rest, feet on a footstool in the drawing room. And the miracle is several at once partake of the elegance, the form you've set for them. The little table with beautifully folded tiny napkins, the wing-back chair for someone male, the antimacassars for a greasy head, the nursery where the toys are stored as light fades in the little panes, the kitchen where a gentle reprimand may occur until stirring begins again. Instead, in front of it with you, quite consumed by its beauty and order, its grace, assembled out of scraps and rags and translated to a living stage, I breathe, if only I were small enough, were small. And I don't know whether you feel as I do, but when you're given flowers, but today they're so contained in wrappings and windings of ribbon and so forth, that they're not nearly as nice as they, you know, as they would be if they were just a cut bunch of flowers. So this is about a bouquet that I took to pieces and to get the flowers out. It didn't look quite so good when they were all out of it, but it seemed to be natural. Undoing a formal bouquet. All tightly twined it was, with nettings of pink ribbon looping through and an arch of climbing ivy making a maypole dance overhead. And wrapped, no child was tighter swaddled than these blooms were pressed, some in individual sachets of crystals, the roses and the forced tulips, crushed and surrounded by a press of ordinary and variegated leaves. So, ignoring the implied instructions, leave me, leave the floral designer's art. I undid it, and unswaddled, took out the common leaves and discarded the superfluous greenery, hung the netted ribbon above a lithograph where it resembled a tutu, and let the stems, released from their sachets, swim a little in a little more space of tap water, slightly temperate. A beautiful line from Akhmatova begins this poem in memory of my friend Fiona's mother, Flora, which I read at her funeral. I imagined the little footsteps having a moment's breathing space, enough time to be scattered with rose petals before the next footprints arrived. To Fiona, in memory of Flora, and in a deathly sleep rest thousands of footsteps, Akhmatova's line, and now your dear mother, grown so small and frail, but so spirited, lays her footsteps over the others, and you see them leading back and forwards into your life to come, for mothers relinquish nothing that is their children's. Even eternity is a place to step through on hot coals if need be, or ice that cracks and shatters. Nothing deters that bent, determined head, the gaze of eyes so true and truthful. Oh, let petals from fallen roses and vases be laid quickly over her little footprints before another comes. Let them be perfumed and especially light and joyful. This is another poem. This is about my mother. My mother died last year at the age of 97, and a friend, another poet, Diana Bridge, her mother, aged 89, was also dying. And being poets, beside being tender and broken-hearted, we couldn't stop ourselves observing details which no one else wanted to talk about were communicated between us in frank, supportive talk. The Death of Old Women is the poem I wrote for Diana later. The Death of Old Women, for Diana Bridge. Our mothers, we've described symptoms you rarely share outside the family home, and not often there. A scalp affliction, the body's efforts, without conscious consent, it seems, to breathe. What kills us? Lack of air. And how death comes, like someone climbing weary stairs for the last time, forbearing to ever look back again on the view below. I mentioned a blue colouring like the shading of a lamp. You described a fearful rattling sound. Not all of these were shared. Death is individually tailored like all things. A dusty angel with heavy wings and a pocket of tools like a lockbreaker, but gentleness as well, a concern to take each prize into his hands. Rather than the Feast of Death poems, I'm sorry. This is another one. Sorry about that, but this will be the last one about it. I've got a friend called Marga who's a medievalist, and I love staying with her. And when I'm with her, I often take out a book in her bookcase. It's Philip Arrier's wonderful book, The Hour of Our Death. And I take it out into the garden to read. And far from finding it morbid, I find the attitudes to death through the centuries, from swooning knights who said, "I swooned to death," and then did die 4 days later, to the modern hospice, deeply fascinating. It's got fascinating chapters in it. Sitting in Margot's garden reading Philip Arrier's The Hour of Our Death. Every visit, I take it from the bookcase where it lies on its side with leaves inside, pressed between the cover and the frontispiece, leaves as brown and dry as old bones and sharp with the spite of death. I turn the familiar pages and read the headings, the tame death, the death of the self, as if history were portending to a revision deeper than deeds, the age of the beautiful death, complete acceptance or evasion, like two continents in opposite hemispheres. Here, the catacombs of the Capuchin convent Palermo, the odd choir that has just shuffled in to fill the stalls, and here in domestic Montpellier, Vermont, the funerary sculpture of little Margaret, white and pure. How could those skulls that Margaret dug undo her marzipan purity? Look, she might say, running with one as a vessel. What use can we put this to? What use is death? And our attitudes to it. Do they alter in any respect the angel, or just the way we look at him? Those often elevated floor slabs of churches, hiding corruption in a blaze of lead and glass, or the quiet New England burial ground of graves like gentle sheep cropping together in a meadow that seems more eternal than their eliding inscriptions. The dead body, the visit to the cemetery. I close my eyes, then open them to look up at the sky, then the treetops, the climbing sweet peas, the pond with lilies, the cat's grave, commemorated by a little stone wall and a fresh tussie mussie picked that day. Between swooning and fright, between the heartsick night and the hospice, between the neurological bright light, I closed the book I love like a tablet. Now something about music, something about a dream. This was a dream I had, which I embellished quite a lot. It was a dream of being at a ghastly dinner party, sitting opposite a man in tails, and he passed me a note saying, "Do you like hearing the piano played?" So we went out of the, away from the dinner party, through several rooms, and he played me the Goldberg Variations. I can't remember dinner parties as beastly as this, really, and I don't know any men in dinner suits who play the piano, the grand piano. Listening to the Goldberg Variations, a dream of piano playing, I would rise from a long, disagreeable dinner party where some had been insulted, some ignored. I was of the ignored, the cheek turned aside, the gaze downward, the heart raw. When someone opposite, a gentleman in tails, would whisper low or pass a note, "Do you like hearing the piano play?" Quietly we rose and slipped through the door until, several doors dividing, where the air grew quiet and sounds faded, sort of venerable piano with a piano sconce, at which the gentleman seated himself with first smile of the night, a flick of tails, a shooting of cups, a conspiratorial look, and began to play the Goldberg Variations. On the polished floor, I sat in evening dress, slipped off my sandals and my elbow gloves, rested my head against a piano leg, and let all varieties of grief and love flow into resolution and to method. For is not life of stairs composed of climbing melody and deep repose, and this minute by minute's easing, as the white hands with their little hairs on second knuckles rose and tried to slip between the keys until a smile about the time of Quodlibet accrued. In the distance, chairs were held and scraped back and napkins tossed down. "Who cares they've gone?" some brute said as the last notes brought their solace like a plate, and the gentleman in tails got up and snuffed out the candle between a third finger and a thumb. I rose too, stiff and resolved, and walked through the door that opened on the street. And this next one is about my going to Pilates. We can't believe that a person my age would go really go to Pilates, and I tell you it's a formidable thing. I've seen some Pilates bodies, Michael, and they are formidable. I'm in a class of three, and sometimes when the instructor's not looking, I look at my watch and think 20 more minutes torture. Anyway, this was written after a class in which I had tried and failed miserably to do an exercise called the swan, which involves lying on your stomach with your legs and arms in the air, stuck out in front and behind, and rocking backs and forwards like a seal. And I just couldn't do it. But next week I could slightly do it. So it's just called After Pilates. I come home with my head full of strange thoughts, the secret beauty of the word no. Is it because my body failed to do an exercise named after a swan? I think now, were I in command, I would give to my grown-up children a perfect lecture on the dark brilliance inside the no. I often resisted or couched in soft terms, instead of allowing it to shine and balance as my body today used a pulley to slowly lift and restore the numbered vertebrae from neck to tailbone as I curled and uncurled. Now, I don't know whether you've seen this calendar by Edward Gorey. Last Christmas, a friend called Barbara sent it to me. It's called The Glorious Nosebleed, and each month is illustrated by a pair of magical drawings which show adverbs in action. There are marvellous drawings that illustrate things like the pudding was served distractedly, the piece was sung excruciatingly, she let it go quickly, that's when someone picks up a snake, to name just three. So I decided this would be the year of adverbs. It's called the year of adverbs. Don't open this impetuously before Christmas. You've written in capitals across the brown cardboard stiffened wrapper. But 2 days before, feeling in need of, it turns out, adverbs, I do, and restore myself with Edward Gorey's The Glorious Nosebleed's glorious placements. This will now be a year devoted to adverbs. Adverbs can push adjectives aside, and if it comes to a choice, they can be the darlings that go quickly. For adjectives are often lewd, wrapped in mufflers endlessly, or walking aimlessly in deserted woods. A baleful regard will not hurt them. They are part of the jaded furniture, even if they get themselves up killingly. See April, inadvertently, jadedly, they must go. Gorey sends so many subjects outdoors with only an adverb to comfort them. Vaporously, yearningly, the tears flow tearfully, and there is mainly snow, except for someone dancing girlishly on sand and lightly clothed. Here is the trunk, presumably, buried nearly to its clasps in snow, and here the drawing room concert, excruciatingly, in which the stage cannot be viewed, but a tormented aspidistra waves. Outdoors and in are both claustrophobic without an adverb to escape by, quickly, zealously, maniacally. An adverb can even escape from another adverb of lesser vitality, numbly sitting on the train, or yearningly, the arms around a monument. This shall be as month, zealously on month, floats in misty garments through the year, and an adverb bites each end, the year to honour them, to find in every incident the adverb which summarises it and points. And finally, two pleasurable things that happened. I remember thinking that, and this happens as you get a little older, is that you don't do the wonderful things that you used to do as a child, like running on wet grass or getting drenched in the rain, absolutely drenched. And you become more cautious, you take umbrellas and all that sort of thing. Anyway, one day I got thoroughly drenched in the rain. I got so drenched that I couldn't go to work, I had to go home and get changed. A great downpour. I did have an umbrella, but it was utterly useless. And it's just called Singing in the Rain. I am caught at the bus stop like Gene Kelly, only I have an umbrella. Just 2 days before, I said to someone, we miss all those good experiences, getting drenched, and here is my chance. Heavier and heavier, the hem of my coat, my neck, my feet inside my shoes, I stand on tiptoe to escape the overflow. My skirt looks like Eliza Bennett crossing half of Hertfordshire, pneumonia at least. And then I remember hearing on the radio it's Richard Rogers' anniversary and begin to hum the commemorative song they played, younger than springtime, low and sweet, and somehow insistent. Now it seems the heavens have personally opened to test if getting wet really was my heart's desire. No one else is near. I stay for half an hour beside the bus stop sign. The bus has broken down. Gene Kelly splashes and kicks his feet while I go on humming, Heaven and Earth Are You to Me. And lastly, something I saw when I was at the Melbourne Festival earlier this year, and I'm sure I'll never forget this busker in his horse's head playing the accordion and the beautiful pathos he created. I wanted to rush up and embrace him. It was just the most beautiful horse's mask. It was a sort of a dull matte black, and it was so elegant and heartbreakingly beautiful. And he was dressed in a tunic and striped hose and breeches, and he was playing a tiny little pink and a red and yellow accordion, and he was playing it so as though he was in a world of his own. It was just beautiful. Horse playing the accordion. That's something you don't often see as the courtesy car goes past, the low steps of the festival hall, a horse playing the accordion, a beautiful black horse's head, so elegant and refined, its profile would break your heart if he turned or lifted his hands from the accordion, which is red and yellow, quite dainty, and his tunic, like a medieval page, a dried blood red, his stockings below his knee breeches, white and red satin rings. Everything is pathos, everything so designed to bring together the horse playing the accordion with a hat, black, wide-brimmed, for donations, casually at his feet or hooves. Let me out. I want to give everything in my purse to the beautiful horse and his accordion.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. We'll talk for a little while only, and then I'll open it up to questions. And to close off, as I said, Elizabeth will have a couple more poems to give us. When you read the poem A Cortege of Daughters, you said you thought I'd remember it because it was an older one and so on. It's most peculiar, purely as it happens. I remember it far better than you might guess, because it's a poem I clipped from the TLS in April, I think, of 89, when it appeared there. I'd fallen in love with the poem immediately. And when you, this is interesting, I believe it's interesting, when you later collected it in a volume, you changed one word in the poem. And I had that outraged sense that I'm sure a lot of us have had when we've really taken to a poem, and the poet goes back and tinkers with it and does something. And I can point to the exact phrase in question and get you to justify yourself now. That's lovely. It's in the final stanza. It goes, "And in the midst of their queenliness, one in dark flowered silk, the corpse, etc." And this in the TLS was one in dark sprigged silk. And I fell in love with that phrase, and it vanished and became dark flowered silk. And I have a theory which you can correct or whatever. I thought this may be because sprigged silk is a little difficult to say, or it may be because flowered is a more plain word, and a lot of Elizabeth's aesthetic, it seems to me, is about plain talking, plain language. So I'd like her to put a frame around her choice of the word, why it was changed.
Well, Michael, I think it was changed by the TLS, because I didn't actually change it myself. They probably thought this ignorant woman, what she really means is sprigged silk, and all I meant was silk with flowers on it, so dark flowered silk, that's all I see, but they possibly changed
they
it.
They changed it without asking you?
Yes, probably.
Well, now I'm truly scandalised.
I think one is so grateful to be in the TLS, it doesn't matter what they do to your poems.
I was thrilled that you read a couple of poems that first appeared in magazines that I had edited. And I'm darn sure that I would never have dreamt of changing a word of yours, at least not without asking whether it was what you really meant. Let me ask another question then, which is also to do with your language. You do both. You do the fiction and you do the poetry. And it seems to me that a lot of platitudes are always bandied about poets' fiction, and the way it's very poetic, and whatever that means. I think, in a sense, Elizabeth's stories and novels are not poetic, if by that we mean that they don't have characters and they don't have plot. They do. They have both words. But they're all the way through, there are wonderful phrases where I stop, and I think, oh, I must remember that, or I must steal that, or something like that. There's one which is in a beautiful story in this book, which is about an old lady on the first day that she goes into a home, one of those places, and her son is in the offing, and there's a description of the son's money worries, and he's thinking about the money that the old lady still has, conservatively accumulating like a layer of dead leaves in a drain. I remember stopping, just reading that several times, thinking, oh God, how good. Because so much of his attitude to his mother, the pointlessness of her money, how I could use it. All it's just condensed into that one wonderful image, isn't it? And you think, oh, to write an image like that, how well. And in a way, this is the poet marrying the fiction writer, isn't it? To me, it's a marriage made in heaven at that moment. I think that is so good. What I want you to tell us about, and especially those who are often engaged in trying to decide what the left hand or right hand will do today. Is today a fiction day? And if it's a fiction day, does it mean I have to write no poetry? And so on and so forth. How do you reconcile the two parts of your writing life? Do they exclude each other or do they live off each other?
I think, Michael, I think of them as different. If I'm writing a story, the stories I write, I like to write a story that's about 5,000 words long. I don't know why I do that, but it's just sort of a number of words that really appeals to me. It's long enough to have chaos in the middle of it, and then for the end to suddenly rise up like the sort of you're swimming and your feet touch the bottom. But very often with that 5,000 word length, there's a part in that you might start boldly, just as you might start a poem boldly, and then there's a chaotic part in the middle. So if I was writing a story, I would write a certain number of words a day. I actually like to write stories very slowly. I like to write about 250 words a day, which doesn't take very long, about 20 minutes or something. And then I like to sort of sleep on it and then let the unconscious sort of carry on. But when I start a story, I like to work on it, you know, with a very strict timetable so that, and I, in the front of an exercise book, I have this really primitive and stupid way of going about it. But I write, I keep a sort of mathematical thing. I write down 250, 500, 750, 1,000, and I cut them out as I go. And the rule is that you have to write that number. Like you have to get up to 500. If you go to 507, that's so much the better. Or 520, that's less you've got to do the next day. But you always have to do that particular number. And so it's not like poetry in that at all. It's a totally different form, really. And there's a lot of crashing around in the middle, but I always find that somewhere in the middle, I think I'm losing the plot here. I don't know what I'm doing. But then it's very rich when somehow you pick up the pen the next day and you start writing your dismal words, your 250 words or whatever it is, and you just keep going. And suddenly it starts to develop again. And I think fiction relies terribly much on the unconscious. It relies on, once you start it, you're asking your unconscious to bring up material for you, and that's even more so than normal. Once you start, you must keep going, because the unconscious, weak sort of creatures it seems at the beginning, actually waits for you to, perhaps it's like running, you know, you go out running on the streets and first of all you can't do it at all and you ache all over, but after a while, when your body gets used to it, it sort of says, how about a run this morning? And it's sort of waiting for you to, it's ready to sort of do it, you know, and that's one of the things about writing I think that's so fascinating. I don't think the poetry's like that at all. I like to write poetry about once a week and have a session of reading good poets and then writing them. And I like to write about five poems at a time if I can. But I'm not a poet that writes, does a lot of revision. Sometimes I write alternate words under the line where I haven't got the right word. But what I like to do, and I think there are two schools of poets. There's been a survey done many years ago, I think, in America, where they found that about 50% of the American poets wrote slowly. You know how Alan Kuno, he came to dinner at once when I was in Auckland, when I was a literary fellow, and as Alan and his wife approached the door of the house I was staying in, Jenny, his wife, whispered to me, she said, Alan's had a very good day, he's written three lines. And I thought, three lines, is that all he's done? But that was a good day, because Alan works so hard on the lines, and you'll never know when you read a poem by him that he's worked so hard, because it's so beautiful, it's so well done. But I like to write in a rush. I like to try and do everything at once, like as if I'm juggling. I try to think and to feel and to ponder and to be faintly intellectual as I can. And I like to concentrate on the subject I'm writing about. And I like to do everything at once, sort of rolling the whole thing over. And it can end in utter failure, so you have to just cross it out and then perhaps go on to the next thing. And sometimes the best poems have already undergone in your mind a sort of digestion, so they're sort of ready. Otherwise you can write something that seems like an exercise, really. But no, I find them quite different, Michael, quite different forms. And I think with literary forms, you can I have a theory, you can feel the form. You can feel the form of the short story. It says, this is what a short story is. And you say, no, it's not. It's going to do this. And you keep pushing, and it pushes you back, because this is the tradition of the short story. And you say, I'm going to write a short story with 32 characters. And it says, well, you can write a short story with 32 characters if you want to, but you just try. And it'll, you know, you get this sort of interaction between you and the form. So it's not just a case of writing about my feelings. It's a case of the actual short story itself as a genre, which is quite demanding, you know. Particularly the theatre would be demanding, because if you said you were going to write a play with 23 acts and it was going to go on for 4 days, well, I mean, it wouldn't work, would it? I mean, no one would come to see it, probably. But, and it would soon let you know that wasn't going to work for you.
You just, in passing, made a little self-deprecatory remark about what did you say, as intellectual as I get, or something like that. It seems to me that one of the appeals of your writing lies in your ability to broach material which can at times be difficult, not necessarily in the poems you read tonight, but to do it in very accessible and plain-talking terms. I'm thinking perhaps particularly of a number of poems which are arguably, I'd say, underrepresented in the selection here, which are to do with religious subject matter, saints' lives, this sort of thing, that this whole area of Catholicism, Catholic experience, it can be for some readers somewhat recondite, and for others it might seem forbidding. But you're able to speak of these things with humour and with very open accessibility and so on. That seems to be an important principle for you. It's not only, I suppose, there is an antipodean thing, isn't there, about avoiding an appearance of pretentiousness and so on, but it seems also a personal idea of communicability or something. Do you want to say something about that?
About communication.
Yes, and the importance of your reader-author relation, I suppose, is what is being asked.
Well, I have a strong feeling that though we all have very individual experiences, one of the things we need to do is to... If I just change the pronouns, it's really my life story too. So I've always had a sort of regard that our life stories, though they're terribly, terribly important to us, they're not the only thing. There's also life itself, which is something that we puzzle and try to find out about. What is life really like? You know, try to observe all the time. Looking hard is very important. As for communication, I think that the poem should be as difficult as the subject matter requires, but no more difficult than that. And you should say it as simply as you can, but if the thought is complicated, then I think the language may be a little complicated to cover that. I mean, you can't make a thing simple if it's a complex thought, but you don't make it deliberately obscure either. You should struggle on behalf of the reader and on behalf of yourself to make it as easily comprehensible as you possibly can.
Let me open this out to you now, and do bear with me if I repeat your question. That's not so much in case you haven't been heard by other members of the audience, it's in case the microphones don't pick it up for the recordings that are done here. So would anyone like to ask Elizabeth something else about the craft or about individual poems maybe that you heard this evening? The lady over here.
I think you should not take notice of anybody who gives you advice. I think you should just be yourself. You know, there are wonderful poets, and you read them, and you think, if only I could write like that, if only I could be Robert Lowell or William Empson or something. But it's nonsense. You just have to be yourself. I think that the great way to fight is not to worry about style. Just concentrate on what you're trying to write about. Focus on it utterly, like Keats would have done. Absolutely absorbed in what the subject matter is. That's perhaps not a very fashionable concept now. And your style will flow into it, but keep it clearly in front of you. And, you know, because we're all unique, you know, if you broke into a bank, you'd leave your own fingerprints behind. So you don't worry about being unique in style. Don't even think about style. Just concentrate on what it is you're writing about and look at it as hard as you possibly can and as much, you know, removing from yourself sentimentality, anything that's easy, you know, do it, you know, make it hard for yourself. But that's what I like to do, to concentrate on the, you know, whatever it is that's in front of you, whatever you're trying to say. And then I think you get the most style. You know, it's not the person who sets out to say, I've got a great style. It's the person who's unconscious. You know, the way children have great style and great movement, the way a child moves beautifully. It doesn't need to go to Pilates. It just moves beautifully as it is. It's only old people like myself who get creaky and think, oh, I'm not walking properly any longer. You know, not something that goes to Pilates. But that's what I would do.
Okay, the question, just briefly for the microphone, excuse me, Elizabeth, is about the process of drafting and the form that the poem takes.
I have to confess, I'm not very good at it. The more I've written, the more musical my poetry's perhaps become, and the more inner rhymes they are. My publisher in Auckland says they're getting more musical as I get older. But what I like to do, I'm not a great writer of sonnets or forms. I mean, I think those forms are extremely hard, and maybe when I'm older still, I'll be able to really do something like that. What I like to do, though, is if I start off writing a poem and it turns into four-line stanzas, say, then I like to answer it back with another four-line stanza. So the first stanza might say something, but the second stanza might answer it back, and then the next one will come. Each one is slightly different, with a different voice, rather like, you know, the way poetry began in churches with a choir answering back. And I found there is a great difference in the poem that is all joined up. The poem that's three lines or two lines, you know, there seem to be great differences between this. Once you've chosen the stanza length, there seems to be it becomes a different sort of poem, almost a different sort of thinking, really. And I suppose, really, in lots of ways, I haven't got the skills to write some of those beautiful poems that are so damn good, and then you look at the end of it and you think, oh no, he's rhymed every second line as well as this. The secret, of course, about complicated forms is, if you use them, is that you must not notice them. You mustn't get to the end of the line and see it going clunk, 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 where the poet searches for the rhyme. You've got to read the poem for its sense, and then when you look back, you think enviously how beautifully they've done it. But the sense of the poem is the most important thing. And if you're not able to do that, you're probably better to rely on rhymes, half rhymes, near rhymes, which are very beautiful, actually in the poem itself. And that's what often happens, really. So any rhyming abilities I've got, I'm really pretty unconscious of them. But hopefully, perhaps one day I might be able to do that, because it's such a great skill.
Yes, up at the top there, Victoria. This is about the word flowered or sprigged in a cortege of daughters.
Yes.
If Elizabeth had a second chance, which word would she use and how would she justify either?
I would have still stuck with flowered, because sprigged is not a word that came naturally to me. So, you know, and that can be a case of ignorance. You know, I mean, I'm more ignorant than the TLS. I mean, that's obvious. But I mean, I can't. I was writing the poem. I was trying to think of what the woman was wearing. I didn't sort of stop and rush and get the dictionary. What's that foot sort of silk called? You know. So in a case, it's ignorant in a way. But no, flowered was what I flower. I think the flowers were more important to me than the sprigged. What does sprigged mean, anyway? I mean, what does it mean flowers or not? Yes. Yes, so the flowers are more important to me. So if someone had said, well, why don't you call it sprigged silk, I would have still gone for flowers, because a person looking at the woman would have noticed that the flowers on her silk dress. So. No, probably not. No. I mean, I don't think it matters terribly if you know, the more you write, the more you become aware that there's very subtle differences and tiny, tiny little things in words. You know, one word just very slightly changed can make a huge difference. But I'm quite a careless writer in lots of ways, I'm afraid. And I don't mind that too much, because I think it gives a certain amount of energy, you know. I don't mind that the person at the funeral observing it didn't use perhaps the best word, as long as they use the best line at the end, which is really an important part of the poem. Because what I was thinking of at the end was a big lake, which is actually sort of like a city reservoir, and it's got it's surrounded by it's got banks of irises around the outside of it. And I suppose that's the image I got, was it sort of the dark poppy and the image of the flowers around the outside of it. And so it was careless, but I still wouldn't have gone for spring. Yes.
Gentleman over here. This is a question about the experience of reading poetry in silence oneself versus the possible loss when it's read aloud, or gain, I suppose.
Well, that's right. It sort of swings and roundabout things, really. Mm. I mean, I write poetry. I never really set out to be a poetry reader. And when I'm at home, I read poetry on the page. I immerse myself in poetry. And when you read it on the page, you often read a poem several times to get the thing. I don't think really reading it aloud in a public reading, and you have to remember that most poets are not great readers. I mean, we've sort of been pushed into this sort of reading thing, and there are some who read brilliantly, and some like myself who I think read just adequately. And the best, but I have a friend who's an actress in London. We have lots of discussions about whether actresses are really better at reading it, because, you know, they breathe beautifully and they do all that sort of stuff. But I had a curious experience once. In the very first reading I gave, when I was, and I think it was a dreadful reading, we read really badly. There was a group of women who just read at this sort of coffee bar place, and a very old woman got up and shouted at us. She said how badly we enunciated and what dreadful performance. But it was interesting that even though we read badly, we held the audience was interested in us, whereas a woman got up later and read some Sylvia Plath, and she was an actress, and I was watching and the audience sort of turned off. So the too beautiful voice, the too controlled voice, is not quite right either. So it's sort of somewhere in between. But I think the real pleasure is in reading it yourself privately. That's what I would say. And if you come to a poetry reading, you know, you get something out of it. And perhaps an image strikes here, but then the poem's moved on, so by the time one image has gone onto your head, another one's coming up, so it's very hard to get it, really. So I would say the real pleasure is in reading it privately. That's the last thing, you know. And I think I remember once going into Auckland University Library, and here was a young girl sitting on the floor reading one of my books of poems, and I thought, that's the greatest thing that can happen to a poet, is that someone's crouching on the floor reading your poetry. And I think reading privately is the thing, really. And sometimes you read a poem through and you dive into it and you don't really get it, and then you read it again and something else comes out of it and suddenly it cracks open like a nut or something and you see it. So I think it would be very rarely that you get that from a public reading, because things often go past me all the time. So I would say private reading, really. But because today poets seem to have to read in public, so they do it. And, you know, you have to forgive them, because they're not very great effort, most of us.
Yeah. There's nothing else over here.
No. She's got the poem, but she can't put it on the wall because her husband might see it. No, I don't think I'd ever write about anyone in a spiteful or horrid way, but it's just, they quite like it. It's sort of like doing portraits of them in a way. And just recently I've read some really beautiful poems that describe clothing, and that would be a nice thing to do, to describe an outfit or something. It's just really examining a friendship in a sense, just describing describing this. The minute Carol arrives at my house, out comes this little tin and starts rolling two roll your owns. And I never can say to her, look, I don't really feel like one, I've got a sore throat, because it's like a test of the friendship. So we'd sit there puffing away on a roll your own cigarettes, because she hasn't been really able to give it up completely, But it's also a sort of a friendship thing, I think. So far no one's been offended by it, unfortunately. I think it's, in a way, it's just sort of like doing a little portrait, looking portraits of them through something.
Here's another question.
To do is actually carry a notebook, and I just make the notes of what I want to write about. I knew I wanted to write about the horse and the recording the minute I saw it, but I don't have any sort of timetable. What happens is that when I was at Auckland University as a fellow, I tried to write poetry every day and it didn't work for me. I just couldn't push myself that hard, and I realised that writing about once a week was about the right thing for me. But if I haven't written for a while, I get a sort of a malaise, a sort of irritable feeling, and I think to myself, what's the matter with you? And then I realise I should go and write some poetry, and that'll make me feel sort of a whole again. So I always think of Margaret Thatcher, who I thought was a horrible person, but I remember her saying, she was visiting somewhere where there was a woman in a wheelchair who was complaining bitterly about everything, and I think Margaret Thatcher said, well, what's really the matter? And I think her wheelchair needed a new screw or something like that. So I I treat myself like Margaret Thatcher. I think, what's the matter with you? Go and do some writing. Go and write some poetry. So that sort of malaise and irritability is when I act on it. It's usually about once a week I have a go at writing some poetry. And it's just keeping it going. If you didn't do it for a while, you'd sort of lose everything. So I think particularly that applies to poetry. Just keep yourself sort of limber. So even if you have a writing session and you write a whole lot of rubbish, and the books I write in these blank exercise books, quite good ones, it's pages and pages with scratches, scratched through, And when you come to type them up on the word processor, I have what I call that Hemingway thing with the inbuilt ship detector, and you have to sort of, you have to look at it, is this really working? No, scratch it out. So you try to have that critical sort of be.
Shall we make this the last question then and come back to Elizabeth for a couple of final poems? Of confidence goes into a transparent smile?
Well, I don't know. You hope that it might be the case. It might be that I don't have a very good vocab or something, but but I don't like to be obscure. I like to communicate with people. I've worked as a librarian for years, so I'm always answering reference questions and stuff, and I'm quite often saying to people, what do you really mean? People will come in and they they say, where's the medical section? And then you take them to it and they say, have you got anything about them? And you finally realize it's some quite obscure disease now to look up. I like a mix of language. I like a mix of simple language with the odd difficult word thrown into it. But I don't like it to be any more difficult than it needs to be. No more difficult than required, in a way. And I think it possibly is vocab too. I mean, I don't know how big my vocab is. Probably moderate size, I suppose. But no, perhaps I'm answering your question very badly as I am now. What I should say is I love directness. And perhaps that's the sort of confidence. I like to leap into the subject matter, boots and all, sort of, without much preamble. And because that's part of the character of poetry, to be direct. That's what I really, really like, to be as straightforward and direct as I can, and just focus on the thing, really.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth, very much for very instructive and helpful remarks about how you approach the craft. Let me, before I hand you back to Elizabeth for a couple of final poems, remind you all that next week in this space, same time, same place, we have Wendy Cope. The week after that, we have a mini festival of writers from the southwest of the US, and I'd ask you to get details of those readings from the leaflet, because there are four or five of them, as I remember rightly. Can I also remind you that Elizabeth's book, The Selected Poems for the British Market, A Question of Gravity, published by ARC, is on sale outside as you go out. Elizabeth will be very pleased to sign copies if you want your copy signed. And I think you get a percentage on the door as well, so this is the moment to buy it at an advantageous price. Thank you for coming. I'm now going to shut up and hand you back for a couple more poems from Elizabeth.
Thanks, Michael. And I'd like to thank you very much for coming too. It's a great pleasure to have you here. I thought I'd just read a couple of poems about a cat, my cat. All our cats have been called after publishers. We have Blackie and Doubleday and all that sort of stuff. So the cat I have at the moment is called Strauss, after Pharaoh Strauss and Giroux. This is just a poem about him. He's an enormous ginger cat. A cat called Strauss, not the musical family of Viennese waltzes, but the middle publisher of Pharaoh, Strauss and Giroux. He will not need to explain my name has only one S, or my ancestors were Jewish cats, or I particularly love books, because all cats are publishers. Every night a new book arises in the moonlight over the hunting garden. And this is an occasion when I was listening to Handel with him. I think Handel's Water Music, and I think he was lying on the tiles, and I thought he looked rather bored, as if Handel was fairly conventional. And so this is a poem with quite a complicated thought, and it's very hard to read because it's got a great big long sentence, and I'll probably make a terrible mess of it. And it's called Listening to Handel with a Cat. Sometimes, and I think the cat thinks this, after ordinary quotidian things, lying stretched on the red tile floor in the summer heat, or reading in a chair, where there is nothing distracting or deep, for Handel seems conservative, even to a cat, music makes its own way as water does, and swells with sufficient volume between confining banks, which stalwartly resist to the exact pitch of water flow, until, and here the cat stirs and his whiskers twitch, randomness comes, as if every drop resolves to go magisterially and slow, and everything is resolve, and not a drop is wasted, not a vapour above the darkening river in the mist, but everything accrues to grand and majestic. Thank you very much for asking.